His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Book 1, The Golden Compass. Part 2, Olvanger. Chapter 10, The Consul and the Bear. John Farr and the other leaders had decided that they would make for Trollesund, the main port of Lapland. The witches had a consulate in the town, and John Farr knew that without their help, or at least their friendly neutrality, it would be impossible to rescue the captive children. He explained his idea to Lyra and Fardacorum the next day, when Lyra's seasickness had abated slightly. The sun was shining brightly and the green waves were dashing against the bows, bearing white streams of foam as they curved away. Out on the deck, with the breeze blowing and the whole sea a-sparkle with light and movement, she felt little sickness at all. And now that Pantalaimon had discovered the delights of being a seagull and then a stormy petrel and skimming the wave-tops, Lyra was too absorbed by his glee to wallow in landlubberly misery. John Farr, Fardacorum, and two or three others sat in the stern of the ship, with the sun full on them, talking about what to do next.
"Now Fardacorum knows these Lapland witches," John Farr said, "and if I ain't mistaken, there's an obligation there."
"That's right, John," said Fardacorum. "It were 40 years back, but that's nothing to a witch. Some of them live to many times that."
"What happened to bring this obligation about, Fardacorum?"
said Adam Stefanski, the man in charge of the fighting troop.
"I saved a witch's life. She fell out of the air, being pursued by a great red bird like to nothing I'd seen before. She fell injured in the marsh, and I set out to find her. She was like to drowning, and I got her on board and shot that bird down, and it fell into a bog, to my regret, for it was as big as a bittern, and flame red."
The other men murmured, captured by Fardacorum's story.
"Now when I got her in the boat, I had the most grim shock I'd ever known, because that young woman had no demon."
It was as if he'd said she had no head. The very thought was repugnant. The men shuddered, their demons bristled or shook themselves or cawed harshly, and the men soothed them. Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's arms, their hearts beating together.
"At least that's what it seemed. Being as she'd fell out of the air, I more than suspected she was a witch. She looked exactly like a young woman, thinner than some and prettier than most, but not seeing that demon gave me a hideous turn."
"Ain't they got demons then, the witches?"
said the other man, Michael Canzona.
"Their demons is invisible, I expect,"
said Adam Stefanski.
"He was there all the time, and Fardacorum never saw him."
"No, you're wrong, Adam. He weren't there at all. The witches have the power to separate themselves from their demons a mighty sight further than what we can. If need be, they can send their demons far abroad on the wind or the clouds or down below the ocean. And this witch I found, she hadn't been resting above a hour when her demon came a-flying back, because he'd felt her fear and her injury, of course. And it's my belief, though she never admitted to this, that the great red bird I shot was another witch's demon in pursuit. Lord, that made me shiver when I thought of that. I'd have stayed my hand. I'd have taken any measures on sea or land. But there it was. Anyway, there was no doubt I'd saved her life. And she gave me a token of it, and said I was to call on her help if ever it was needed. And once she sent me help, when the Skraelin shot me with a poison arrow. We had other connections, too. I haven't seen her from that day to this, but she'll remember."
"And does she live in Trollesund, this witch?"
"No, no, they live in forests and on the tundra, not in the seaport among men and women. Their business is with the wild. But they keep a council there, and I shall get word to her. Make no doubt about that."
Lyra was keen to know more about the witches, but the men had turned their talk to the matter of fuel and stores, and presently she grew impatient to see the rest of the ship. She wandered along the deck towards the bows, and soon made the acquaintance of an able seaman by flicking at him the pips she'd saved from the apple she'd eaten at breakfast. He was a stout and placid man, and when he'd sworn at her and been sworn at in return, they became great friends. He was called Jerry. Under his guidance, she found out that having something to do prevented you from feeling seasick, and that even a job like scrubbing a deck could be satisfying if it was done in a seaman-like way. She was very taken with this notion, and later on she folded the blankets on her bunk in a seaman-like way, and put her possessions in the closet in a seamanlike way, and used stow instead of tidy for the process of doing so. After 2 days at sea, Lyra decided that this was the life for her. She had the run of the ship, from the engine room to the bridge, and she was soon on first-name terms with all the crew. Captain Rokeby let her signal to a Holland's frigate by pulling the handle of the steam whistle. The cook suffered her help in mixing plum duff, and only a stern word from John Farr prevented her from climbing the foremast to inspect the horizon from the crow's nest. All the time they were steaming north, and it grew colder daily. The ship's stores were searched for oilskins that could be cut down for her, and Jerry showed her how to sew, an art she learned willingly from him, though she had scorned it at Jordan and avoided instruction from Mrs. Lonsdale. Together they made a waterproof bag for the alethiometer that she could wear around her waist in case she fell in the sea, she said. With it safely in place, she clung to the rail in her oilskins and sou'wester as the stinging spray broke over the bows and surged along the deck. She still felt seasick occasionally, especially when the wind got up and the ship plunged heavily over the crests of the grey-green waves, and then it was Pantalaimon's job to distract her from it by skimming the waves as a stormy petrel, because she could feel his boundless glee in the dash of wind and water and forget her nausea. From time to time he even tried being a fish, and once joined a school of dolphins, to their surprise and pleasure. Lyra stood shivering in the forecastle and laughed with delight as her beloved Pantalaimon, sleek and powerful, leapt from the water with half a dozen other swift grey shapes. He had to stay close to the ship, of course, for he could never go far from her. But she sensed his desire to speed as far and as fast as he could for pure exhilaration. She shared his pleasure, but for her it wasn't simple pleasure, for there was pain and fear in it too. Suppose he loved being a dolphin more than he loved being with her on land. What would she do then? Her friend the able seaman was nearby, and he paused as he adjusted the canvas cover of the forward hatch to look out at the little girl's demon skimming and leaping with the dolphins. His own demon, a seagull, had her head tucked under her wing on the capstan. He knew what Lyra was feeling.
I remember when I first went to sea. My belly sorry I hadn't settled on one form, I was that young. And she loved being a porpoise. I was afraid she'd settle like that. There was one old sailorman on my first vessel who could never go ashore at all because his demon had settled as a dolphin and he could never leave the water. Oh, he was a wonderful sailor. Best navigator you ever knew. Could have made a fortune at the fishing, but he wasn't happy at it. He was never quite happy till he died and he could be buried at sea.
Why do demons have to settle? I want Pantalaimon to be able to change forever. So does he.
Oh, they always have settled, and they always will. That's part of growing up. There'll come a time when you'll be tired of his changing about, and you'll want a settled kind of form for him.
I never will.
Oh, you will. You'll want to grow up like all the other girls. Anyway, there's compensations for a settled form.
What are they?
Knowing what kind of person you are. But take old Belisaria. She's a seagull, and that means I'm a kind of seagull too. I'm not grand and splendid, nor beautiful, but I'm a tough old thing, and I can survive anywhere and always find a bit of food and company. Ah, that's worth knowing, that is. And when your demon settles, you'll know the sort of person you are.
But suppose your demon settles in a shape you don't like?
Well, then, you're discontented, aren't you? There's plenty of folk who'd like to have a lion as a demon, and they end up with a poodle. Until they learn to be satisfied with what they are, they're going to be fretful about it. Waste of feeling, that is.
But it didn't seem to Lyra that she would ever grow up. One morning there was a different smell in the air, and the ship was moving oddly with a brisker rocking from side to side instead of the plunging and soaring. Lyra was on deck a minute after she woke up, gazing greedily at the land. Such a strange sight after all that water, for though they had only been at sea a few days, Lyra felt as if they'd been on the ocean for months. Directly ahead of the ship, a mountain rose, green-flanked and snow-capped, and a little town and harbour lay below it. Wooden houses with steep roofs, an oratory spire, cranes in the harbour, and clouds of gulls wheeling and crying. The smell was of fish, but mixed with it came land smells too, pine resin and earth and something animal and musky, and something else that was cold and blank and wild. It might have been snow. It was the smell of the north. Seals frisked around the ship, showing their clown faces above the water before sinking back without a splash. The wind that lifted spray off the white-capped waves was monstrously cold and searched out every gap in Lyra's wolfskin, and her hands were soon aching and her face numb. Pantalaimon, in his ermine shape, warmed her neck for her, but it was too cold to stay outside for long without work to do, even to watch the seals, and Lyra went below to eat her breakfast porridge and look through the porthole in the saloon. Inside the harbour the water was calm, and as they moved past the massive breakwater, Lyra began to feel unsteady from the lack of motion. She and Pantalaimon avidly watched as the ship inched ponderously towards the quayside. During the next hour the sound of the engine died away to a quiet background rumble. Voices shouted orders or queries. Ropes were thrown, gangways lowered, hatches opened.
"Come on, Lyra," said Vardar Korum. "Is everything packed?"
Lyra's possessions, such as they were, had been packed ever since she'd woken up and seen the land. All she had to do was run to the cabin and pick up the shopping bag, and she was ready. The first thing she and Vardar Korum did ashore was to visit the house of the Witch Council. It didn't take long to find it. The little town was clustered around the harbour, with the oratory and the governor's house the only buildings of any size. The Witch Council lived in a green-painted wooden house within sight of the sea, and when they rang the bell it jangled loudly in the quiet street. A servant showed them into a little parlour and brought them coffee. Presently the consul himself came in to greet them. He was a fat man with a florid face and a sober black suit, whose name was Martin Lancelius. His demon was a little serpent, the same intense and brilliant green as his eyes, which were the only witch-like thing about him, though Lyra was not sure what she had been expecting a witch to look like.
"How can I help you, Vardar Korum?"
"In two ways, Dr. Lancelius. First, I'm anxious to get in touch with a witch lady I met some years ago in the fen country of Eastern Anglia. Her name is Seraphina Pecola."
Dr. Lancelius made a note with a silver pencil.
"How long ago was your meeting with her?"
"Must be 40 years. But I think she would remember."
"And what is the second way in which you seek my help?"
"I'm representing a number of Egyptian families who've lost children. We've got reason to believe there's an organization capturing these children, ours and others, and bringing them to the north for some unknown purpose. I'd like to know whether you or your people have heard of anything like this going on."
Dr. Lancelius sipped his coffee blandly.
"It's not impossible that notice of some such activity might have come our way. You realize the relations between my people and the Northlanders are perfectly cordial. It would be difficult for me to justify disturbing them."
Vardar Korum nodded as if he understood very well.
"To be sure. And it wouldn't be necessary for me to ask you if I could get the information any other way. That was why I asked about the witch lady first."
Now Dr. Lancelius nodded as if he understood. Lyra watched this game with puzzlement and respect. There were all kinds of things going on beneath it, and she saw that the Witch Council was coming to a decision.
"Very well. Of course that's true, and you'll realize that your name is not unknown to us, Vardar Korum. Seraphina Pecola is queen of a witch clan in the region of Lake Enara. As for your other question, it is of course understood that this information is not reaching you through me."
"Quite so."
"Well, in this very town there is a branch of an organization called the Northern Progress Exploration Company, which pretends to be searching for minerals, but which is really controlled by something called the General Oblation Board of London. This organization, I happen to know, imports children. This is not generally known in the town. The Norway government is not officially aware of it. The children don't remain here long. They are taken some distance inland."
"Do you know where, Dr. Lancelius?"
"No, I would tell you if I did."
"And do you know what happens to them there?"
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius glanced at Lyra. She looked stolidly back. The little green serpent demon raised her head from the consul's collar and whispered tongue flickeringly in his ear. The consul said,
"I have heard the phrase the Meierstadt process in connection with this matter. I think they use that in order to avoid calling what they do by its proper name. I have also heard the word intercision, but what it refers to I could not say."
"And are there any children in the town at the moment?"
He was stroking his demon's fur as she sat alert in his lap. Lyra noticed that she had stopped purring.
"No, I think not. A group of about 12 arrived a week ago and moved out the day before yesterday."
"Ah, as recent as that? Then that gives us a bit of hope. How did they travel, Dr. Lancelius?"
"By sledge."
"And you have no idea where they went?"
"Very little. It's not a subject we're interested in."
"Quite so. Now, you've answered all my questions very fairly, sir. And here's just one more. If you were me, what question would you ask of the Council of the Witches?
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius smiled.
I would ask where I could obtain the services of an armoured bear.
Lyra sat up and felt Pantalaimon's heart leap in her hands.
I understood the armoured bears to be in the service of the Oblation Board. I mean, the Northern Progress Company, or whatever they're calling themselves.
There is at least one who is not. You will find him at the sledge depot at the end of Langlochur Street. He earns a living there at the moment, but such is his temper and the fear he engenders in the dogs, his employment might not last for long.
Is he a renegade, then?
It seems so. His name is Yorick Birnison. You asked what I would ask, and I told you. Now here is what I would do. I would seize the chance to employ an armoured bear, even if it were far more remote than this.
Lyra could hardly sit still. Fardacorum, however, knew the etiquette for meetings such as this, and took another spiced honey cake from the plate. While he ate it, Dr. Lancelius turned to Lyra.
I understand that you are in possession of an alethiometer,
he said, to her great surprise, for how could he have known that?
Yes,
she said, and then, prompted by a nip from Pantalaimon, added,
would you like to look at it?
Oh, I should like that very much.
She fished inelegantly in the oilskin pouch and handed him the velvet package. He unfolded it and held it up with great care, gazing at the face like a scholar gazing at a rare manuscript.
How exquisite! I have seen one other example, but it was not so fine as this. And do you possess the books of readings?
No.
Lyra began, but before she could say any more, Fardacorum was speaking.
No, the great pity is that although Lyra possesses the alethiometer itself, there's no means of reading it whatsoever. It's just as much of a mystery as the pools of ink the Hindus use for reading the future. And the nearest book of readings I know of is in the Abbey of St. Johann at Heidelberg.
Lyra could see why he was saying this. He didn't want Dr. Lancelius to know of Lyra's power. But she could also see something Fardacorum couldn't, which was the agitation of Dr. Lancelius's demon, and she knew at once that it was no good to pretend. So she said,
actually, I can read it,
speaking half to Dr. Lancelius and half to Fardacorum, and it was the consul who responded.
That is wise of you. Where did you obtain this one?
The master of Jordan College in Oxford gave it to me. Dr. Lancelius, do you know who made them?
They are said to originate in the city of Prague. The scholar who invented the first alethiometer was apparently trying to discover a way of measuring the influences of the planets according to the ideas of astrology. He intended to make a device that would respond to the idea of Mars or Venus as a compass responds to the idea of North. In that he failed, but the mechanism he invented was clearly responding to something, even if no one knew what it was.
And where did they get the symbols from?
Oh, this was in the 17th century. Symbols and emblems were everywhere. Buildings and pictures were designed to be read like books. Everything stood for something else. If you had the right dictionary, you could read nature itself. It was hardly surprising to find philosophers using the symbolism of their time to interpret knowledge that came from a mysterious source. But, you know, they haven't been used seriously for 2 centuries or so.
He handed the instrument back to Lyra and added,
may I ask a question? Without the books of symbols, how do you read it?
I just make my mind go clear, and then it's sort of like looking down into water. You've got to let your eyes find the right level, because that's the only one that's in focus. Something like that.
I wonder if I might ask to see you do it?
Lyra looked at Fardacorum, wanting to say yes, but waiting for his approval. The old man nodded.
What shall I ask?
What are the intentions of the Tatars with regard to Kamchatka?
That wasn't hard. Lyra turned the hands to the camel, which meant Asia, which meant Tatars, to the cornucopia for Kamchatka, where there were gold mines, and to the ant, which meant activity, which meant purpose and intention. Then she sat still, letting her mind hold the 3 levels of meaning together in focus, and relaxed for the answer which came almost at once. The long needle trembled on the dolphin, the helmet, the baby, and the anchor, dancing between them and on to the crucible in a complicated pattern that Lyra's eyes followed without hesitation, but which was incomprehensible to the two men. When it had completed the movement several times, Lyra looked up. She blinked once or twice as if she were coming out of a trance.
They're going to pretend to attack it, but they're not really going to, because it's too far away, and they'd be too stretched out.
Would you tell me how you read that?
The dolphin. One of its deep-down meanings is playing, sort of like being playful. I know it's the 15th because it stopped 15 times, and it just got clear at that level but nowhere else. And the helmet means war, and both together they mean pretend to go to war, but not be serious. And the baby means, it means difficult. It'd be too hard for them to attack it. And the anchor says why. Because they'd be stretched out as tight as an anchor rope. I just see it all like that, you see.
Dr. Lancelius nodded.
Remarkable. I'm very grateful. I shall not forget that.
Then he looked strangely at Father Coram and back at Lyra.
Could I ask you for one more demonstration? If you look out of this window, you'll see a shed with 40 or more sprays of cloud pine hanging on the wall. One of them has been used by Serafina Pecola, and the others have not. Could you tell which is hers?
Yeah,
said Lyra, always ready to show off, and she took the alethiometer and hurried out. She was eager to see cloud pine because the witches used it for flying, and she'd never seen any before. The two men stood by the window and watched as she kicked her way through the snow, Pantalaimon bouncing beside her as a hare, to stand in front of the wooden shed, head down, manipulating the alethiometer. After a few seconds, she reached forward and unhesitatingly picked out one of the many sprays of pine and held it up. Dr. Lancelius nodded. Lyra, intrigued and eager to fly, held it above her head and jumped and ran about in the snow, trying to be a witch. The consul turned to Father Coram and said,
Do you realize who this child is?
She's the daughter of Lord Asriel, and her mother is Mrs. Coulter of the Oblation Board.
And apart from that?
The old Egyptian had to shake his head.
No, I don't know any more. But she's a strange, innocent creature, and I wouldn't have her harmed for the world. How she comes to read that instrument, I couldn't guess. But I believe her when she talks of it. Why, Dr. Lancelius, what do you know about her?
The witches have talked about this child for centuries past. Because they live so close to the place where the veil between the worlds is thin, they hear immortal whispers from time to time in the voices of those beings who pass between the worlds. And they have spoken of a child such as this, who has a great destiny that can only be fulfilled elsewhere. Not in this world, but far beyond. Without this child we shall all die, so the witches say. But she must fulfill this destiny in ignorance of what she is doing. Because only in her ignorance can we be saved. Do you understand that, Father Coram?
No, I'm unable to say that I do.
What it means is that she must be free to make mistakes. We must hope that she does not, but we can't guide her. I'm glad to have seen this child before I die.
But how did you recognize her as being that particular child? And what did you mean about the beings who pass between the worlds? Well, I'm at a loss to understand you, Dr. Lancelius, for all that I judge you're an honest man.
But before the consul could answer, the door opened and Lyra came in, bearing a little branch of pine.
This is the one! I tested them all, and this is it, I'm sure. But it won't fly for me.
Well, Lyra, that is remarkable. You're lucky to have an instrument like that. I wish you well with it. I would like to give you something to take away with you.
He took the spray and broke off a twig for her.
Did she really fly with this?
Yes, she did. But then she is a witch, and you are not. I can't give you all of it because I need it to contact her, but this will be enough. Look after it.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
And she tucked it into her purse beside the alethiometer. Father Coram touched the spray of pine as if for luck, and on his face was an expression Lyra had never seen before, almost a longing. The consul showed them to the door, where he shook hands with Father Coram and shook Lyra's hand too.
I hope you find success,
he said, and stood on his doorstep in the piercing cold to watch them up the little street.
He knew the answer about the Tartars before I did,
Lyra told Father Coram.
The alethiometer told me, but I never said. It was the crucible.
I expect he was testing you, child. But you done right to be polite, being as we can't be sure what he knows already. And that was a useful tip about the bear. I don't know how we would have heard otherwise.
They found their way to the depot, which was a couple of concrete warehouses in a scrubby area of waste ground, where thin weeds grew between grey rocks and pools of icy mud. A surly man in an office told them that they could find the bear off duty at 6, but they'd have to be quick, because he usually went straight to the yard behind Einarsson's bar, where they gave him drink. Then Fardacorum took Lyra to the best outfitters in town and bought her some proper cold-weather clothing. They bought a parka made of reindeer skin, because reindeer hair is hollow and insulates well. The hood was lined with wolverine fur, because that sheds the ice that forms when you breathe. They bought underclothing and boot liners of reindeer calfskin, and silk gloves to go inside big fur mittens. The boots and mittens were made of skin from the reindeer's forelegs, because that is extra tough, and the boots were soled with the skin of the bearded seal, which is as tough as walrus hide, but lighter. Finally, they bought a waterproof cape that enveloped her completely, made of semi-transparent seal intestine. With all that on, and a silk muffler around her neck and a woolen cap over her ears and the big hood pulled forward, she was uncomfortably warm. But they were going to much colder regions than this. John Farr had been supervising the unloading of the ship, and was keen to hear about the witch consul's words, and even keener to learn of the bear.
"We'll go to him this very evening. Have you ever spoken of such a creature, Fardacorum?"
"Yes, I have, and fought one too, though not by myself, thank God. We must be ready to treat with him, John. He'll ask a lot, I've no doubt, and be surly and difficult to manage, but we must have him."
"Oh, we must. And what of your witch?"
"Well, she's a long way off, and a clan queen now. I did hope it might be possible for a message to reach her, but it would take too long to wait for a reply."
Well, now let me tell you what I found, old friend."
For John Farr had been fidgeting with impatience to tell them something. He had met a prospector on the quayside, a new Dane from the country of Texas, and this man had a balloon of all things. The expedition he'd been hoping to join had failed for lack of funds even before it had left Amsterdam, so he was stranded.
"Think what we might do with the help of an aeronaut, Fardacorum,"
said John Farr, rubbing his great hands together.
"I've engaged him to sign up with us. Seems to me we struck luckier coming here."
"Luckier still if we had a clear idea of where we were going,"
said Fardacorum. But nothing could damp John Farr's pleasure in being on campaign once more. After darkness had fallen, and when the stores and equipment had all been safely unloaded and stood in waiting on the quay, Fardacorum and Lyra walked along the waterfront and looked for Einarsson's bar. They found it easily enough, a crude concrete shed with a red neon sign flashing irregularly over the door, and the sound of loud voices through the condensation-frosted windows. A pitted alley beside it led to a sheet metal gate into a rear yard, where a lean-to shed stood crazily over a floor of frozen mud. Dim yellow light through the rear window of the bar showed a vast, pale form, crouching upright and gnawing at a haunch of meat which it held in both hands. Lyra had an impression of blood-stained muzzle and face, small malevolent black eyes, and an immensity of dirty, matted, yellowish fur. As it gnawed, hideous growling, crunching, sucking noises came from it. Fardacorum stood by the gate and called.
"Yorak Bjornason?"
The bear stopped eating. As far as they could tell, he was looking at them directly, but it was impossible to read any expression on his face.
"Yorak Bjornason? May I speak to you?"
Lyra's heart was thumping hard, because something in the bear's presence made her feel close to coldness, danger, brutal power, but a power controlled by intelligence. And not a human intelligence, nothing like a human, because, of course, bears had no demons. This strange, hulking presence gnawing its meat was like nothing she had ever imagined, and she felt a profound admiration and pity for the lonely creature. He dropped the reindeer leg in the dirt and slumped on all fours to the gate. Then he reared up massively, 10 feet or more high, as if to show how mighty he was, to remind them how useless the gate would be as a barrier. And he spoke to them from that height.
"Well, who are you?"
His voice was so deep it seemed to shake the earth. The rank smell that came from his body was almost overpowering.
"I'm Fardacorum, from the Egyptian people of Eastern Anglia. And this little girl is Lyra Belacqua."
"What do you want?
We want to offer you employment, Yorick Bjornason.
I am employed.
The bear dropped on all fours again. It was very hard to detect any expressive tones in his voice, whether of irony or anger, because it was so deep and so flat.
What do you do at the sledge depot?
I mend broken machinery and articles of iron. I lift heavy objects.
What kind of work is that for a Panzerbjörn?
Paid work.
Behind the bear, the door of the bar opened a little way and a man put down a large earthenware jar before looking up to peer at them.
Who's that?
He said.
Strangers, said the bear.
The bartender looked as if he was going to ask something more, but the bear lurched towards him suddenly and the man shut the door in alarm. The bear hooked a claw through the handle of the jar and lifted it to his mouth. Lyra could smell the tang of the raw spirits that splashed out. After swallowing several times, the bear put the jar down and turned back to gnaw his haunch of meat, heedless of Fardacorum and Lyra, it seemed. But then he spoke again.
What work are you offering?
Fighting, in all probability. We're moving north until we find a place where they've taken some children captive. When we find it, we'll have to fight to get the children free, and then we'll bring them back.
And what will you pay?
I don't know what to offer you, Yorick Bjornason. If gold is desirable to you, we have gold.
No good.
What do they pay you at the sledge depot?
My keep here in meat and spirits.
Silence from the bear. And then he dropped the ragged bone and lifted the jar to his muzzle again, drinking the powerful spirits like water.
Forgive me for asking, Yorick Bjornason, but you could live a free, proud life on the ice, hunting seals and walruses, or you could go to war and win great prizes. What ties you to Trollesund and Einarsson's bar?
Lyra felt her skin shiver all over. She would have thought a question like that, which was almost an insult, would enrage the great creature beyond reason, and she wondered at Fardacorum's courage in asking it. Yorick Bjornason put down his jar and came close to the gate to peer at the old man's face. Fardacorum didn't flinch.
I know the people you are seeking, the child cutters. They left town the day before yesterday to go north with more children. No one will tell you about them. They pretend not to see because the child cutters bring money and business. Now, I don't like the child cutters, so I shall answer you politely. I stay here and drink spirits because the men here took my armor away, and without that, I can hunt seals, but I can't go to war. And I am an armored bear. War is the sea I swim in and the air I breathe. The men of this town gave me spirits and let me drink till I was asleep, and then they took my armor away from me. If I knew where they keep it, I would tear down the town to get it back. If you want my service, the price is this. Get me back my armor. Do that, and I shall serve you and your campaign, either until I am dead or until you have a victory. The price is my armor. I want it back, and then I shall never need spirits again.